On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Bernardo Kastrup about his new book, Why Materialism is Baloney.
I'd like you to talk about this emergent property of the brain idea, where we're still 100% brain-based, but somehow we introduce this idea of an emergent property of the brain.
Yeah, I think it's an appeal to magic. It's a label for something that we don't know or that we can't even conceive. We give it a label and it sounds like we know because we gave it a name. Consciousness cannot be deduced from spin, momentum, mass of subatomic particles. You simply cannot deduce the redness of red, the pain that we feel when we lose a loved one. You cannot deduce that phenomenology from the material world.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we welcome back Bernardo Kastrup to put an explanation point on a couple of topics we've been kicking around here on Skeptico for a while. Bernardo's always a very popular guest on this show, and I think this interview will remind you why. Today, we welcome Bernardo Kastrup back to Skeptico. Bernardo has a PhD in computer engineering and has worked as a scientist in some of the world's leading research laboratories, including those particle-smashing folks at CERN. He's here to talk about his new book, Why Materialism is Baloney. He's been a very popular guest on Skeptico, and it's great to have you back, Bernardo. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back. I was missing it. It's been fun last time.
Well, it's fun to have you here. Tell us about this book with this very provocative title that won't be surprising to a lot of our listeners, but certainly will be provocative to a lot of people. Why Materialism is Baloney?
Yeah, first time I disclosed this title, I think it was on the Skeptical Forum, and people were sure my publisher wouldn't accept it, and I thought probably they won't, but at the end of the day they did, and I'm very glad. It reflects the essence of the book. It's an effort I made over the past few years to organize my own thoughts about why materialism simply doesn't make sense, why it sounds so plausible, because it's so embedded in the culture for so long, for 300-400 years since the beginning of the Enlightenment. But if you really look into it, you see that it doesn't add up. Not only does it not add up, it's also not necessary to explain reality.
Tell folks, before we get too far into it, we have to just start at the beginning. What are we talking about when we talk about scientific materialism? What is it?
I personally, I like to split these words, but when people say scientific materialism, it's a philosophical and ontological interpretation of science. Science itself is just a study of the patterns and the regularities that we can observe in reality. It doesn't carry with it a interpretation in terms of saying, oh, this is outside mind or not. It doesn't matter for pure science. Scientific materialism is when you load the scientific observations of the regularities of nature with an ontological interpretation, and you say what we are observing here is matter outside of mind that has an existence that would still go on even if nobody were looking at it. That is already an interpretation. It's not really pure science anymore. And the essence of materialism, scientific materialism, is that it's just what I said, that the real world is outside of mind. It's independent of mind, and particular arrangements of elements in that real world, namely subatomic particles, generate mind, generate subjective experience. Now, of course, the only carrier of reality anyone can know is subjective experience. So materialism is a kind of projection, an abstraction, and then a projection onto the world of something that is fundamentally beyond knowledge.
And what you say in the book, and I like the way you put this, you say it's our fundamental metaphysical assumption. And I think that's going to catch a lot of people by surprise, because those are not words we generally associate with science. And yet, as you point out, we've done this little sleight of hand, or I guess our current paradigm has done this sleight of hand where they're taking metaphysics, substituting it for science and saying, oh no, that's what we meant all along. So take what you just said and break it down for us in terms of why you think that metaphysical assumption is, as you plainly say, is just absurd.
Well, materialism is an enormous metaphysical assumption. It abstracts a world fundamentally beyond knowledge, because knowledge is in mind. Knowledge is in subjective experience. When you say that the entire universe is outside of mind, you're postulating something fundamentally outside of knowledge, something that you can only infer if you have very good reasons for it.
So hold on, let break that down for us, because I think it sounds like a simple notion, but it's actually a tricky little thing to say about our experience is in our mind. Break that down for us, the inside-outside thing that you're drawing out there.
Everything that we can ever know in our entire lives, as far as we can ever know, is an experience. It's in mind. It's a subjective experience. So we can break that down with a living example. The computer I have in front of me, the chair I'm sitting on, the table I feel with my hands, the lights, the office where I am, these are all experiences. Color, shape, smell, sound, these are all experiences. They're all in mind. And that's the only reality we can know. It's the things we can touch, the things we can see, the things we can smell. What materialism says is that that is all created by your brain, and therefore it's all inside your head. The real world has no color, has no sound, has no shape. The only thing you can compare it to is a mathematical equation, because it's completely abstract, according to materialism. In that sense, materialism is an incredibly strong metaphysics, strong in the sense that it's far out and unnecessary, because it says that reality is not what you live every day, it's not what you experience every day, that's just an epiphenomenon, something created inside your head. Reality is like a mathematical equation, it's pure abstraction, fundamentally beyond knowledge. That is metaphysics, even more metaphysics than spiritual realms, because people who are religious, at least they expect that they will get to a spiritual realm at some point, maybe after death. And the metaphysics of materialism entails that the real reality will never be directly accessible by us, because it's fundamentally outside experience. It cannot be experienced. It's only an abstraction of mind.
One of the terms you use in the book to drive this point home is the idea of self-localization. And I love this analogy that you've really used for a couple of years, but it's a great one, and that is the whirlpool. Tell us about the whirlpool and this idea that a whirlpool generates water. Well, of course, that's absurd.
Yeah, and if the body, the brain-body system, is a localization of mind, like a whirlpool is a localization of water.
Break that down for us. A whirlpool is a localization of water.
Yeah, that's what it is, right? If you look at the whirlpool, it's water going around in circles for a little while. It's a process in water that reflects a localization of the flow of water. Now, if all reality is mind, and I argue that there is no reason to think otherwise, then the body-brain system is an image of the localization of the flow of mind. That localization of the flow of mind is our egoic personal consciousness. And of course, it's localized. We've lost awareness of the rest of existence. Our awareness is very localized. We only know the world immediately around us. And the analogy I make is that the body-brain system is to mind like a whirlpool is to water. It's simply the image of a process of mind. It's not the cause of that process of mind, in the same sense that a whirlpool doesn't cause water. It doesn't generate water. It's the image of a process of water flowing in a localized manner. The same applies to the body-brain system. And in fact, that explains why there are so many correlations between brain states and subjective states. One is the image of the other. So, of course, they are to some extent correlated.
Very good. You know, as you know, we've talked about this topic quite a bit on this show and have interviewed some folks who hold very firmly to this materialistic view of consciousness, of mind. There's also, I think I've noticed, and I'm sure you have too, there's a certain fallback position that people have gotten into when they realize that that's kind of, there's a certain absurdity to that, which you're pointing out. You're more than pointing out, you're kind of pounding over the head with them. And their fallback position, I think, is interesting. I think it's equally absurd, but I'm kind of tipping my hand. I'd like you to talk about this emergent property of the brain idea, where we're still 100% brain-based, but somehow we introduce this idea of an emergent property of the brain. Start by explaining how that is used, who's saying it, what position they're taking, and then what is your take on that?
Yeah, I think it's an appeal to magic. It's a label for something that we don't know or that we can't even conceive. We give it a label and it sounds like we know because we give it a name. Right. Emergence is a phenomenon that exists. For instance, sand dunes are an emergent phenomenon of grains of sand and wind. They form beautiful patterns. And when you look at those patterns, they are unexpected. How could just grains of sand and wind form those patterns that look designed? But these are all examples of what philosophers call weak emergence. Basically, weak emergence is when you have a phenomenon that is surprising compared to its components, like in this case, sand and wind, but which is still explainable by its components. You can still deduce the properties of what you're seeing from the properties of its basic components, like grains of sand and wind. You can simulate sand dunes on a computer and get the same beautiful patterns. What people who call consciousness an emergent phenomenon of the brain appeal to is what David Chalmers, a philosopher, calls strong emergence. And that's when the phenomenon you observe, the emergent phenomenon, cannot be deduced from the properties of its components. Consciousness cannot be deduced from spin, momentum, mass of subatomic particles. You simply cannot deduce the redness of red, the pain that we feel when we lose a loved one. You cannot deduce that phenomenology from spin, charge, momentum, mass and whatever from the material world. So that's an example of what philosophers would call strong emergence. And I am of the opinion that strong emergence is incoherent. It's an appeal to an unknown. It's an appeal to magic. It's not only an unknown. It's something that we can't even conceive. There is a gaping black hole in our view of reality. We give it a name and we say, we will find out about this in the future. And it looks all cozy and warm and we get that fuzzy feeling as if we're almost there. But in fact, there is a universe to be breached here, one that will never be breached because it's incoherent. It's based on a fundamentally flawed interpretation of reality. That's the position I take.
Yes, and I would wholeheartedly agree. It's the ultimate passing of the buck, if you will. It's like, let somebody else worry about it. I have this fancy term that I can throw on it. So I'm glad we're of like mind about that. But you know, that really leads us into another question I wanted to ask. It's a little bit outside of your domain, but not really, because you've been in these battles. You've battled this prevailing yet absurd paradigm. And I think one of the things that I bump up against over and over again, and I think I feel like I have to communicate to people that are on this journey with me is the, I always phrase it as the, how can this be question, you know? So you get at this for a while and you realize, one, that there's that this existing paradigm doesn't make sense, that there's a lot of evidence for mind consciousness somehow being fundamental, and that evidence pops up again and again. And then you return and you go, but wait a minute, there's all these smart people that think otherwise. How can it be? Moreover, there's a whole society and culture that works and functions that's been built on this. Again, how can this be? And I think for people that are kind of parachuting into this topic or have even just kind of nibbled around the edges and are trying to really grasp it, that's one of the big challenges. How can this be? How can everyone be so wrong, Bernardo, and you're right?
Materialism, I think, is absurd when you look at it in detail. But it does, on first sight, it does seem to explain at least two things that are very fundamental to our experience of reality. And I think that is the strength of materialism, and that's why it has gained so much momentum over the past couple of hundred years. The first thing is, if the world is fundamentally in mind, why can't I change reality at will? If it's a dream, why can't I just dream something else? I'm lucid, after all. The second thing is, if it is a dream, why do we all share the same dream? How come if I'm looking at the waves at the beach and somebody else is sitting next to me, that person will be seeing the same waves? How can a dream be shared like that? And materialism apparently explains these two things by saying the world is outside of mind. That's why you cannot change it by simply wishing it to be different. And because it's outside of mind, it can be concurrently observed by multiple minds, which would then get analogous experiences of that outside world. Now, the problem is there are other ways to explain both the independence of the world from our egoic volition, our egoic wishes, and the fact that reality is shared. And we do not need to postulate an entire abstract and unprovable universe fundamentally outside mind and outside knowledge to make sense of reality. And this is one of the things that I spend quite a bit of space in the book to explain these two empirical aspects of reality in a much more parsimonious way. But to answer your question, I think materialism has originally gathered momentum because of these two things, this explanatory power it has to make sense of these two fundamental aspects of our experience of reality. Over time, however, I think psychological reasons would explain that. I mean, Alan Watts already talked about that in the 60s. Real men stare the facts in the face, right? We are just matter, and we are going to die, and there will be nothing left. And if you're a real man or a real human being, you stare the facts in the face, and you acknowledge that. So in a sense, it has become so popular precisely because it is so negative and so counter to the human nature. It makes people feel like, I don't know, like they are getting a badge of honor by admitting to this, like they're more courageous and more intelligent than the foolish masses that are trying to delude themselves. Of course, none of this has to do with the facts of the matter.
Right. But then again, you know, where does this take us? And you just alluded to that. And you're a scientist. Don't you worry about this leap that we're kind of taking, this leap of faith? But then again, I guess you have what you think is a worldview that allows us to stay inside the confines or the principles of science and yet incorporate in a more expansive view of consciousness. So I guess it's time for you to tell us how that might work.
I think science, in its pure form, carries no ontological interpretations with it. It's simply an effort to analyze and model the patterns and regularities of empirical experience. There is nothing in this view that I promote, that reality is fundamentally mind. There is nothing in it that argues against a large part of the experiences of mind unfolding according to stable, strict patterns and regularities. From that perspective, I deny none of science, none of valid science. I don't deny that nature unfolds according to very stable laws. I don't deny that my egoic volition, my egoic wishes cannot change the world on a whim. I don't deny any of that. I think the patterns and regularities of nature are what they are, and we have established that empirically. Of course, that doesn't mean that nature is fundamentally outside mind. We are observing those patterns and modeling them in mind. So in my mind, in my view of the world, a particular ontological interpretation like idealism, a form of which I promote, does not deny any of science. I am in perfect peace with my scientific mind and my scientific history and way of thinking, despite holding the ontological position I hold. In fact, I think it is a much more parsimonious position and as such much more in line with the spirit of science.
Explain to us then your position regarding idealism.
I reject the notion that reality is fundamentally outside our empirical, our subjective experience, that reality is an abstract world outside mind, outside consciousness, which is the fashionable word to use these days. I think the dualism that there is not a fundamental dualism of mind-matter. It's a dualism of identification. I think if parts of mind self-localize, like a whirlpool self-localizes in water, an illusion is generated, an illusion of identity that makes us identify with that whirlpool, with this body-brain system. And that creates an outside world that is outside egoic volition. The ego is the localization. So indeed, the rest of reality is outside the control of the ego, because the ego is the whirlpool, not the stream in which the whirlpool is located. Egoic volition cannot change the world at will, simply by wishing it to be different. That dualism is there. It doesn't deny that all reality is in mind. And a shared dream can originate in this model if you consider that there can be multiple whirlpools in the stream, continuing on with the analogy, and yet there can be ripples in that stream that penetrate many whirlpools, injecting the same information or analogous information into many whirlpools at the same time. In my mind, that accounts for the fact that empirical reality is shared and not an idiosyncratic solipsist dream.
Okay, but Bernardo, come on. We're going to have a hard time. A lot of folks are going to have a hard time connecting that to their life. And I think that's the challenge for science. It's the fundamental flaw of science. It's lost its mission statement, and that is to provide meaning and to help us understand meaning, to help us nudge a little bit closer to those big truth questions we have. You know, who are we? Why are we here? So if that's your take on it, nudge us a little bit closer. What does this mean?
Okay, let's try to bring it closer to our own personal experience of reality. Think about your dreams. When you dream at night, you dream of an entire universe, a world in that dream, maybe a street, a house, a city, whatever. And you dream of a character in that dream, which you identify yourself with during the dream. And while you are in that dream, you think that you are that character and that the rest of the dream is the outside world. So I can dream of being a man in a house, walking around the house, and thinking this house is outside of me because I identify only with that little character in the dream. When I wake up, it's obvious to me that the whole thing was generated by me. I was not only the little man walking around, I was the house too, and the city. I was the entire dream. My mind was doing the whole thing. But a split-off psychic complex of my mind has turned into the little character in that dream, and I identified myself with that subset of what my mind was generating, even though I was the whole thing. Now, let's bring it back to reality. In my view, reality is a shared dream. We are the split-off complexes of the dreamer. The difference is there are more than one now in this shared reality. We are dreaming the whole thing up. We just happen to be dissociated in identifying ourselves with only a little character in the dream. If this is true, then reality is the dream, and that dream is in us, not us in the dream, in the same way that your nightly dreams are in your mind, not you in it.
But don't we still have this subject-object problem, or really a question that we have to answer? Who is the me? Who is the I in this equation that you keep talking about? There does seem to be, my experience is, and everyone, I think, I can only speak for myself, but no, our experience is that there is an I, there is a me. How do you factor that into it? I mean, it's fine to say that I was dreaming and that was just a dream, and now likewise, I am experiencing life, but that is dreamlike. There still is a subject in that equation that is behind all this in your understanding, in your worldview. Parse that out. What does that mean? Who am I?
I think if reality is fundamentally mental, there is no reason to postulate more than one subject. If everything is mind, then there is mind. Mind is the subject. Objects are imaginations within mind, which are observed from several different points of view of mind. From that perspective, there is only one subject, and you are that subject, and I am that subject too. What happens when we think of ourselves as separate people is that we mix up our fundamental sense of I-ness, so to say, with the stories that are playing in our minds, and we think that we take our identity from those stories, as opposed to that fundamental sense. For instance, you still have the same fundamental sense of I-ness that you had when you were a kid, I think. You still think of yourself as the same person you were when you were 5 years old. There isn't probably a single atom in your body that is the same. Your thoughts are different, your body is different, the reality around you is different, your opinions are different, your dreams are different. Everything about you is different. And yet, you have the same sense of I-ness because there has been a continuity throughout that time. Now, you may identify yourself with a story in your mind today. I am Alex. I live in Southern California, and I do skeptical. That's a story. Your fundamental sense of I-ness has no story around it. And from that perspective, it's completely undifferentiated. I have the exact same sense of I-ness that you have. And probably a fish has the same exact sense of I-ness. If you strip the stories away, there is no differentiation. It's just that I am feeling that that we all have. I think that I am feeling is the only thing that is absolutely true. Everything else is imagined. It's a story that we or whatever other split off psychic complexes of that one mind come up with.
Okay, good enough. A couple of things. First, you have to appreciate, and I'm sure you do, that this resonates with so many of the spiritual traditions that have been around for ages. And it also resonates with the work that's done by consciousness researchers, contemplatives who sit and meditate and go through transformative spiritual experiences and come back and say the exact same thing. But they bring with it a lot of other information about filling in that gap, because you have to recognize and speak to this. There is a huge gap between this notion that we really can't conceive from our little brain here of this one consciousness, this one mind. We really can't get from there to our existence, then the existence of us inside of a group, like in my family that I love and care about and have some connection to. And then if I accept the idea that I may have lived a previous life and I may live a future life, to try and bring that idea of one mind that you're talking about, which is a really simple idea, and spread it across this now much larger landscape of experience, much larger than materialism alone would have us kind of understand, is a tough, tough task. Can you really just so simply say, well, you know, in my equation, as you're taking a very scientific computer engineering approach, you know, you're saying, well, the equation says there's just one mind. So, hey, that's it. There's just one mind.
I think strict, logical, and rigorous analysis of the data at hand, our immediate experience of reality and whatever relevant scientific research we can get our hands on, indicates this. To postulate multiple minds having fundamental and fundamentally separate existence is inflationary and unnecessary. It's like postulating the flying spaghetti monster. Maybe it's true, but why would we consider this if things can be explained in a much more parsimonious way?
Yes, but at this point, we've kind of jumped the chasm here and we're on the other side, and everything is speculative. We cannot approach these topics from a scientific standpoint in the same way that we did with our very simple materialism. I think that's part of the allure of materialism. Materialism offers us the promise of measurement, that we really can measure things. This expansive view of consciousness blows that apart and says, you can never measure anything unless you factor in consciousness. And, oh, by the way, we don't really know anything about consciousness. It'll always be that X factor that we can't understand. So to a certain extent, you know, I'm with you to a certain extent, but I think there's a lot of experiences along the way that we have to have some kind of explanation for, other than say, oh, that's just one mind, that's just one mind. I mean, take the near-death experience that we've talked about so much on this show. Take the spiritually transformative experience that isn't associated with a near-death experience. Take the abduction experience, which we've talked a lot about this show and cannot be dismissed, cannot be swept under the rug. Take the psychedelic experience. Again, we've talked about that a lot. you can't just take all these experiences and say, oh, these are outside of our normal conscious experience, but wait a minute, I have the answer. They're all just mind doing what it does. They're just different little whirlpools out there. Perhaps, but I don't think you can just wave your hand and say, oh, those are just other little whirlpools that we'll have to explore later. I mean, it's kind of pulling the same emergent property of the brain trick to a certain extent.
I think you're completely right. I think we can't do that, and it was not my intent to be that dismissive. All my answers are tentative. I approach them from the perspective of someone who has looked at it and has chosen what I think is the simplest and the simplest explanation with the most explanatory power. And the attempt in the book is first and foremost to make sense of our ordinary consensus reality, come up with an ontological interpretation of our observations that could give us a sound explanation for what we ordinarily observe. There are non-ordinary experiences that people have. You alluded to many, alien abductions, spiritual experiences, psychedelic experiences. I do think that we can fit them. I think they do not contradict the philosophy I put forward. Because to say that it's all one mind is to go to one extreme. But we also know that that mind differentiates itself. It has split off psychic complexes, so to say. And there is nothing in this philosophy that requires there to be only two levels, only the one mind and ordinary reality. I don't require that. I do not know what there is in between. Maybe this differentiation, this localization process, happens along an enormous, an incredibly complex hierarchy. Maybe our ordinary reality is only a tiny infinitesimal fragment of everything that is going on when that one mind decides to split itself off and create these realities and observe them from a localized perspective. If it is indeed a decision, instead of just a natural phenomenon, the mind expressing what it is without a plan, which tends to be my position. But I don't deny these things in between or on the sides. I don't deny that there can be realities other than the ordinary one. I don't deny that between this level where we are and recognition, experiential recognition of the one mind, there can be many things in between. And from that perspective, maybe it is valid to talk metaphorically about the soul, not as a ghost floating around in space and time, because that's a materialist idea, but a soul as a form of identity, personal identity, a form of localization that survives physical death. I don't deny the possibility that is the case.
Right, because I think what a lot of people are going to be searching for after approaching this topic and having the resources that you provide in your book and on your excellent website that I have to mention again, Metaphysical Speculations, Bernardo Kastrup. Google that, Metaphysical Speculations, you'll find it. Because this is a topic that you write about frequently from a lot of different angles with a lot of different interaction of things that are happening in the world, in the media, and your response to it and how that fits in. So I think people can get a real sense for you as a thinker who is constantly trying to test your theory against what's going on. But in that same way, one of the things I like to do is kind of venture out beyond the theoretical and beyond the scientific. A show that I really appreciate, and he's been a guest on my show, is Buddha at the Gas Pump. And my buddy Rick Archer over there. And here's a different approach. Look at people who are going through this process of enlightenment, for lack of a better word, and have experienced it from just a wide variety of different traditions. And that's what Rick does. So he has people who are Buddhist, as the name of the show implies, but they're really a small number of those. They're just these people that have either gone through meditation or have had this spontaneous experience or any different ways that they've experienced it. And they come back and they say, there is this larger reality. And Bernardo, so many times, it's exactly the reality that you're talking about. It's a one mind, it's a collective. But along with it, there's a lot of other aspects to it that I think people are really searching for. They're trying to grasp onto. They're trying to understand because they're the meaning questions. They come back and say, you know what? It's important to love other people. You know what? The little things that you do when you connect with other people, that's what it's about. It's about connection. They come back and say, oh, you know what? You really do experience past lives. In those past lives, whether you want to put the term karma on it or whatever, they do have an impact on your current life and on your future life. And then they'll introduce all sorts of other concepts. And they're not always in sync. Sometimes one person says another thing and some person completely contradicts it. But I guess what I'm saying is there's a lot of questions that we have between this idea of materialism, which shuts us down from any kind of expansive view of consciousness, and it shuts us down from approaching any of those topics. So, but there's still a huge gap from that and kind of the what you're giving us and saying, well, there's one mind, so that's where you get. I mean, isn't that in between really where we all live, what we're all struggling with on a day-to-day basis as we try and figure out how to live our life and how to live our life with meaning?
Yes, I don't think that just to say it's one mind, I mean, that's not even the thrust of the book, to say it's all one mind. I mentioned that en passant, and I spend 99% of the book on the implications and ramifications of my view of reality. I don't think it's satisfying to just say, well, it's just one mind, and therefore you don't really die. Your fundamental sense of I-ness will survive any process of mind localization or delocalization that may come up. I agree with that. And I agree we are looking for meaning. My own vision, perspective on the question of meaning is the following. A lot of people from Eastern traditions, mainly, although in the West that happens as well, it's the so-called via negativa, they just say, well, there is only one mind. Everything else are the illusions and dreams of this one mind. Therefore, nothing is really important. I think that's an aloof attitude that is life-denying in a way. It denies the value of our experiences in life, and in a way takes the meaning out of it, because it's just a hallucination of some deity. What's the meaning of that? My perspective is that for the same reason that the lies of a liar tell something about the liar, the illusions of that one mind tell something about that one mind. And I think that is the meaning of life, to engage and observe this dream, because it is a metaphor for something fundamental about the nature of mind. It's mind trying to show to itself what it is through this whole phantasmagoria that we call existence and the universe. And our role is to try to interpret that and to make something out of that. That's mind looking at itself in the mirror. So I don't think the answer, oh, it's just all one mind, I don't think it ends the question at all. I mean, it doesn't even begin to end. It may be true, but it doesn't begin to address the question of meaning. We have to go much further. In that sense, I agree with you.
That's a very interesting and deep, deep thought, because what you're really saying is that it may be one mind, and I'm sorry to keep repeating that oversimplified term, and I know it doesn't capture very accurately what you're really talking about, but I'm going to continue to use it because of what I have. It's even if there's one mind, I am part of that one mind. I am that one mind, or I am part of that one mind. I don't want to get into too many semantic battles. But then what you're saying is my experience of that mind is the only importance I can, and meaning I can derive from mind, can be derived from my experience. So let me look at it, let me contemplate it, and let me be a reflection of it. So it's kind of a give and take process as I try and find that meaning through my life. Is that?
Yes. Let's take a dream. Let's go back to the analogy with the dream. It's amazing how reality is peppered with things that we can use as great analogies for its fundamental nature. And it's almost not by accident, I think. But anyway, we go back to the dream. When you wake up, you know it was a dream. And in that sense, it was, quote, an illusion. It was just something that your mind dreamed up. Yet the entirety of depth psychology is based on the meaning of dreams and what it tells about you, what it tells about what's going on in your unconscious, about your true motivations, your true fears, who you really are, all of your hidden aspects, your shadow and your higher self, and which in psychology would be called the archetype of the old wise man, and so on. So the entirety of a science, depth psychology, in all its variations, is based on the truths that exist behind the illusion of a dream. So to say that things are illusions or dreamed up doesn't empty them of meaning at all, because there is truth to be found in illusion. The illusions are generated by something. Something generates those illusions. And it generates those illusions, not some other illusion. Why is it those illusions? What does it say about the thing that generates it? Because if it generates it, it's expressing its fundamental nature. What is it saying about its fundamental nature when it manifests this universe with all the love and all the hate, and the pain, and the ecstasy, and the beauty, and the ugliness? What is it saying? What does it reveal about the nature of the dreamer? I think there is where the question of meaning lies.
Wonderfully said. So it's all about the asking of the question more than it is about the answer, isn't it?
Oh, without knowing, you made a statement that I just wrote on something new that I'm writing, which I'm cooking in the background. Yes, I think the role of the human intellect, this self-reflective aspect of mind that can only be created through the localization, the folding of mind onto itself, and I think that's the meaning of the localization, only through the intellect can we ask these self-reflective questions like, who am I? What's going on? Why am I here? What's the underlying nature of this all? Without the localization, we would not be self-reflective. We would not be able to ask those questions. The answers don't come from the intellect. It's much too restricted. We see that in our experience of life. The intellect is much too restricted to even describe the beauty of music, let alone the fundamental nature of reality. The answers come from the unconscious, from the non-localized part. But the answers may be lying there if they are not activated by the right questions. They are as good as not being there at all. And I think that's the role of this entire process of localization that makes us lose so much by identifying with the ego and then the body-brain system. But it allows for the asking of the right questions. And I think there, right there, is the meaning of existence. When you ask yourself, what does this mean? What am I seeing? What is this illusion saying? Those are the questions that go straight to the unconscious, straight to the fountainhead of mind, to the core of existence. And something resonates there, I think, but that's my personal experience. It's not really my logical philosophy.
Well, it's a wonderful book. Again, it's Why Materialism is Baloney. Bernardo, how do people get their hands on the book? And tell folks again what's going on with you on your blog and on your excellent YouTube channel. You know, we were chatting a little bit before the show. You've done an excellent YouTube on this book. It's a great way for people to jump in and get a quick overview of what it's about. But you also have on your channel other interviews and dialogues, some really interesting stuff. Tell folks about that.
Yeah, I have a threefold online presence. I maintain this blog, Metaphysical Speculations, which can be found at bernardocastrup.com, or you can search it on Google as well. I just share my thoughts there as they come. I write a number of essays and articles about philosophy, sometimes about other topics as well, answer comments, and normally engaging people on that site. I have my Facebook page where I share links and also share some short thoughts and short ideas that sometimes I have. And the YouTube channel, which is also my name, Bernardo Castro. All are my name, Bernardo Castro. You'll find them all, where I share some of my thoughts in video format and some public presentations I've given and some videos I have done myself, including what you alluded to, this short clip, which is a teaser of the book with a very brief summary of what the book is all about.
Great. Well, folks should definitely check that out and check out this latest book. Bernardo has several other titles definitely worth reading. You'll find all of those on his website. Hey, Bernardo, thanks again for joining me. It's been a great dialogue. It's great getting back in touch, and best of luck with this book.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun again. I'm looking forward to listening to it online.
Thanks again to Bernardo for joining me today on Skeptico. I do have a question to tee up from this interview, and it's a question that Bernardo and I have been battling about for a couple weeks here, and that is, what lies beyond materialism? And do we need a new philosophical paradigm to move us forward? So we've been operating in this mind equals brain, you are a biological robot paradigm, and now some are suggesting that the new paradigm to replace that is consciousness is fundamental. Consciousness is all there is. And as long as we're going there, let me offer up my opinion. And that is, while I can certainly be attracted to how parsimonious and clean that is, consciousness is fundamental, consciousness is all there is, I'm struck by how incomplete that is, how empty that leaves me. In the same way that I am a biological robot leaves me empty, consciousness is fundamental, leaves me empty, leaves me wanting more. But maybe I need to take the advice of our materialist friends and just buck up and accept it, because that's the way that it is. So that's the question or collection of questions I would tee up from this interview. Please join me on the Skeptico forum or in the comments section of the website to chat about that. You can reach both through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. And while you're there, of course, you can subscribe to Skeptico and download what is approaching 250 or so shows of Skeptico. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Have a number of episodes coming up and have a couple of other projects I'm working on, and including pushing towards the finish line of writing this book, which has been quite fun and quite an adventure. So more on that to come later. Until next time, take care and bye for now.